Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Discovery Bible Podcast. Today, Michael and I are going to start in Mark chapter 2, verse 18, and we're going to finish out chapter 3. We have a lot of exciting stuff to talk about. Thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoy the episode. We've started in the book of Mark.
Yeah.
And it's the oldest, the first book that we have recorded.
Yeah.
Of the Gospels, probably the first book that the early church would have used
mm-hmm.
on a regular basis, and then quickly followed by the book of Matthew. And we've kind of jumped in here trying to take a fresh look at the book of Mark as, well, somewhat historically, how would the early church have read this? How would it have landed? How would it have felt to be the first people to read this with fresh perspective? If this is the word of Jesus, this is what we have to go off of. We don't have Romans. We don't have the writings of the Apostle Paul. We don't have all the other New Testament books. We just have the Old Testament and Mark. Then what's it look like?
Yeah, and I think going along that same line of thought, like we started in, I think last week we covered Mark 1 through 2:17,
mm-hmm.
I think is where we went, and just kind of having that perspective of we're going to give credit and not even credit, but just give attention, probably is a better word, to the Old Testament and what Jesus does to incorporate that, and how that's just pretty much foundational for understanding what Jesus is saying. I mean, you have him, I mean, again, like, we don't have to recap too much, but right off the bat, we have quotations from Malachi and Isaiah
mm-hmm.
that Jesus is using.
Mm-hmm.
And then throughout the book, you know, you have John the Baptist being kind of painted in the same light as Elijah,
mm-hmm.
like a new Elijah almost.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you move into Jesus's very quickly into Jesus's life.
Yeah.
The way that Mark does it. So he doesn't, like we talked about last week, he doesn't give that, you know, initial story of Jesus and, you know, his birth and the wise men and all that, the Christmas story, basically.
Right.
You know, he just says, hey, this Jesus was born. Boom. Here we go. Starting on his life.
Right. And that's stated very clearly in the very first verse.
Yeah.
He is the Son of God, as it's written in Isaiah.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just how he jumps in
and
starts off immediately using the Old Testament to say, yeah, see, point proven, point made, point proven, this
mm-hmm.
is who Jesus is. And that's what really the entire first part of Mark is all about. It's you think about it when you have a research paper today. I know you've written plenty of research papers, right?
Unfortunately.
You've done one
back
or two.
In my college days.
You've
done it more recently than I have, though.
Yeah, but the whole idea of researching is you have to include your research within it. And you have to say, this is where I've got source and material to back up my thoughts.
Yeah.
And my thought process goes back to this guy,
mm-hmm.
and he's quoted this guy, and you do all this researching, and you put in these quotes, and you cite authors.
Yeah,
and
you got to do special citing format, APA or MLA, and
all those things.
It's awful, but you're citing. You're not. You're saying, hey, I have original ideas, but this is where these ideas came from, and I can back them up based on XYZ.
And that's what Mark's done.
Yeah,
he has said, this is not just my thoughts that Jesus is the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Isaiah said we should look for this, and this is what it's going to look like. And so when we see Mark is writing down quotes from the Old Testament, it's a citation saying, look, this isn't just, I think he's the Son of God. This is him saying, no, look, he is the Son of God. And he's used these quotes to back it up. And then he goes on, and he makes the point even further by saying, look, even the demons call him the Son of God.
Yeah.
And look, he does things that only God can do,
mm-hmm.
such as forgiving sin and healing a lame man,
mm-hmm.
you know, a paralytic. How can anybody do that unless they are God and themselves?
And you have that reoccurrent theme of, you know, people saying, hey, you are the Son of God, people and you know, demons saying,
mm-hmm.
hey, this is who you are, and Jesus repeatedly saying, hey, don't tell him. And that continues into what we're going to talk about today.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So before we get too much further, who is Mark?
He is an apostle of Jesus, right?
Actually, he's not.
Oh, he's not?
He's not one of the 12.
What?
No.
That's a game changer.
Right? I was actually just watching a show last night, and they're trying to do like a spoof or parody spinoff of like the Lord's Last Supper.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, oh yeah, look over here. It's Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Yeah,
and
no.
And I was like, those guys weren't all disciples. They're not all apostles
Wait
of Jesus.
Wait a second.
Luke was not.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was a...
Luke wasn't either?
Mm-mm.
Dang.
No. Yeah, yeah, no.
So where did these guys come
from? He was
from?
In the medical field like you.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So he's just... So these are guys like after the fact, recording
yes.
stuff, recording
right.
events and stuff that they've heard, have been told,
yeah.
and done
yeah.
research on.
In fact, Mark never fully reveals who he is, but we think he
Ooh.
Might be the rich young ruler. And potentially the Last Supper may have been in Mark's house.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are some of the ideas. But yeah, Mark is not one of the 12. He's not numbered with the 12. And we're actually going to get to that list here in just a little
yeah,
bit.
We
we're
going
to talk about that
yeah,
later today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, yeah. So interesting tidbit of Mark.
Interesting.
So, yeah, yeah. So, but we don't know a whole lot about him. We can assume a few possibilities, kind of read into it and try to figure it out. And there are a lot of theories out there. We're not going to go into all those today. But one theory is that he was potentially the rich young ruler.
Yeah.
And had a close relationship with Jesus, even though he is not numbered amongst the 12. Hmm. So but yeah, so let's jump into Mark today. So we talked a little bit about the story of the paralytic last time. We actually probably talked about it more
yeah.
than we intended to.
Oh,
but
gosh.
That's
yeah,
okay.
Probably.
So we're going to just keep on moving along, and Jesus travels back towards the sea. Have you noticed this theme? And if you haven't, maybe pay attention to it as we jump into the narrative today. How often Jesus is traveling near the sea. You know, Mark didn't have to include that little tidbit. You know, he could have just
He
said,
certainly left out enough
right?
that he didn't have to include
he
that.
Didn't have
He's
to
very
include
specific
it.
In what he includes, so.
Yes, yes. I think that what he includes is done on purpose, and the fact that Jesus is near the sea throughout much of this next section, I think, is significant. So we'll kind of pay attention to that as we jump into it. But yeah, we're going to jump right back into it today. So
okay.
ready
Sounds
to get rolling?
Good. Yeah, absolutely. So we stopped we went through 217. So we're gonna pick up, excuse me, on 218, and then I think what are we going through? 434 is the end of what we're gonna discuss today.
Right.
If we make it that far. Let's see. And so kind of like one of the interesting things like we talked about is how Mark references Isaiah so frequently,
yeah.
you know, and
yeah.
in the first like part of the book that we talked about, Mark is kind of using Isaiah to, you know, describe Jesus and describe mm-hmm. John the Baptist. And I think it's interesting here that it jumps into kind of a different aspect of
mm-hmm.
we're going to in the second part of this, we're going to have parables and Jesus is going to be referencing Isaiah.
Right.
Within those parables. And so you have Isaiah not only referencing, you know, Jesus and John the Baptist, but you have Jesus referencing Isaiah as well.
Right.
And kind of, you know, like you say, kind of bringing up parables and ending them in, you know, a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. He does do that sometimes. He references the stories in the parables of Isaiah and will sometimes say, but this is the fulfillment of it. This is how it's going to be played out here. And again, Jesus has come to make all things new.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's the beauty of it. I'm not sure that we made it all the way through 17, so I'm just going to back us up a little bit to 13 because it says, when Jesus went out again beside the sea, the whole crowd was coming to him, and he taught them. Then moving on, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus. And we may have talked about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I think
minute.
We did. But it's good to reference the by the sea. You
but
know?
He's by the sea, and he calls out to them, follow me, which, again, is the same verbiage that he used to the previous disciples when he called them by the sea to say, come and follow me. And he included, I'll make you fishers of men instead of doing your normal job. He could have said to Levi, I'm going to collect people instead of taxes.
Yeah.
You're going to help me collect souls for the kingdom.
There was a clever metaphor that could have been made there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Jesus missed out.
He missed an opportunity.
Come on, Jesus.
But he calls to Levi and says, "Follow me," near the sea, as he did the other disciples. And then Levi brings Jesus to his house. And of course, the Pharisees are disgusted at Jesus, saying, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" When Jesus heard this, he told them, "Those who are well do not need a doctor, but the sick do need one. I didn't come to call the righteous, but the sinners." Boy, you had to know that had to kind of sting the Pharisees a little bit. When he looks at him and says, "I didn't come to call you."
Kind of a great one. It wasn't maybe not a one-liner, but it was pretty fantastic. Just shut him up.
Because they thought they were the righteous. And Jesus says,
"I haven't come for you.
I've come for the sinners."
Yeah.
Ironically,
they were sinners too. But
Yes, the irony is definitely there. Yeah. So that brings us up to verse 18. Now, John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. People came and asked him, "Why do John's disciples and the Pharisees' disciples fast, but your disciples do not fast?" Jesus said to them, "The wedding guests cannot fast while the groom is with them, can they?" Of course not. That's silly.
That'd be dumb. That'd be a really bad party.
That'd be an awful party.
All right. Terrible. We got married. Let's fast.
Yeah. And as long as they have the groom with them, they cannot fast. But the time will come when the groom is taken away from them, and they will fast in that day. No one sews a patch of unshrunken cloth on an old garment, otherwise the new patch pulls away from the old cloth, and a worse tear is made. And no one puts on new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the wine will burst the skins, and the new wine is lost as well as the skins. But new wine is for fresh wineskins.
There you go.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is that cryptic to you?
I think it definitely is cryptic.
Okay.
And I think it's all kind of put together as one thought.
Mm-hmm.
And the first part of the thought, I think, makes a lot of sense to a lot of people.
Okay.
It's like, you know, we have, obviously, if we look at this Jesus, he doesn't even say. No, he does. I guess he doesn't say he's the bridegroom. But he's making a very obvious, how can the guests of the bridegroom fast? Like, he's referencing fasting, so like, the guest of the bridegroom must be his disciples, and he must be the bridegroom. You know, I mean,
right.
I feel that's fairly obvious.
Well, and we know the other places the Bible talks about Jesus
being the bridegroom.
The bridegroom.
So,
right.
You know, I think that our ability to, you know, look at other places and already have that knowledge kind of there make that, you know, pretty easy to understand. But then you go into this, like verse 21, you go into these other two ideas. Well, really, I guess it's just, is it two? I guess it's like the wineskin and then the the shrunk and the unshrunk garment.
I have like three different ideas here kind of marked out. It's
okay.
Like you've got like the wedding party idea.
Yeah.
You've got the new clothes, old clothes idea. And then you've got new wine, old wine idea.
And I think the new clothes and the old clothes, they're kind of put together and they make sense. Like he's giving two examples to like drive home the same point.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know exactly what that point is. And I've heard it taught different ways. Like, I think the main way I've heard this taught, and I don't know if you want to just jump into this here. Do you have anything to, like, you know, I don't know. I'll just jump into this because I'm kind of wondering how those three ideas connect. Because you say you have three ideas there. Like,
mm-hmm.
Before I get into the idea of, like, what is the new wineskins and stuff, do you have any idea of how, like, the bridegroom and then the idea of, like, wineskin and clothes connect?
Well, that is the question, isn't it? Because Jesus obviously is making one statement.
Yeah, it's not like
he's saying this all fits together.
Yeah.
And for our ears, it's like, what are you talking about? How does an old piece of cloth and a new cloth and old wineskins, how does that
fit in with the wedding party?
Yeah. So let's kind of just go through it real quickly. Because Jesus says, if you're at the wedding party, there should be singing and dancing, right?
Yeah.
That's what we do at a wedding. We sing, we have a good time, we're rejoicing. This is a time to be happy, full of joy. It's not a time of sadness and mourning.
Mm-hmm.
And so that newness is the fact that Jesus is here.
Yeah.
You know, there was a time of grief in the past of Israel's history, and there will be time of sadness in the future. But right now, this is a new time. This is a rejoicing time.
Yeah.
This is exciting. And Jesus is saying, there will be a time in the future. But for right now, Something new has come. God is doing something new. Then we go on to the next piece of this where it says, are you going to put a piece of new cloth that's unshrunk, which is, you know, if you have a woven garment, you have to wash it, otherwise it shrinks down and it doesn't work properly. But are you going to take a brand new piece of cloth, patch it onto an old, worn out garment, and then have it washed and then shrunk and pull away, and it rips that old garment to shreds? It completely destroys it. It doesn't do any good.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make sense. Yeah. Why would you put this brand new cloth on top of a worn out old robe?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
It's not going to fit. It's not going to work.
No. Yeah. And then he goes on to the new wine in old wine skins. Now, back in the time of Jesus Christ, they would have placed wine into a skin. We think of wine bottles or glasses today.
Yeah.
But they would have put it in skins. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in a new skin of an animal, they would have used that. But if you had an old wineskin and you put new wine in it, the pressure as it builds up and it goes through that fermentation process potentially could grow, and it would come to the place where it could potentially burst that old wineskin because it's already stretched.
Gotcha.
It's already been stretched out. It's already been used.
Yeah.
The elasticity has already been
worn
out of it.
Uh-huh.
And so if you place new wine in there, it will burst.
Yeah, which is a bummer.
It's a bummer.
Spilled
absolutely.
Wine, man.
But that's not something that we talk about today. Have you had wine out of an old wineskin recently?
No.
No, we don't really talk about, hey, grab me a wineskin.
Yeah, no. So can I just kind of, I feel like you're going to probably connect to these ideas, but I feel like those two, I kind of touched on this earlier. I feel like those two ideas, like I've heard this preached as kind of the old and the new covenant. Is that kind of like what, you know?
Well, flesh that out for me.
I've heard, let me think. Like I've heard of, you know, the old covenant being represented obviously by like the old garment and the old, you know, wineskin, and the new covenant, obviously the new stuff. And so what I've been taught and what I kind of see here is he's saying, hey, I'm bringing a new covenant. There's no way that you can fit these two together. I'm bringing something new. And if you try to fit that into your old way of thinking, then it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to go to shreds. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to put the new ideas, the new covenant with a new way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Have I been taught
you're
correctly?
Tracking. You're
okay,
tracking.
Good.
Yes, I think you're absolutely tracking.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think what the Pharisees wanted to do
is
place Jesus in the old system.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, they continue to do that. We'll read about that today.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
And Jesus is saying, that doesn't work. That just simply doesn't work. You can't take this wonderful thing that God is doing and force it into your system of thinking.
Gotcha.
And Jesus is going to take a moment, and just like that new skin, he said, is going to tear apart the old garment.
Yeah.
Look what Jesus does. He kind of tears apart their arguments.
Yeah.
Sorry about you. You know what I mean? He's kind of laying this out. And in another sense, he's kind of going to burst their bubble, if you want to use it like that way too.
Gotcha.
So I think this is a little bit prophetic in what Jesus has come to do with their whole mentality and whole system of thinking, where, Jesus is going to do something so completely radically different than anything that they really even wanted. They wanted some form of their system that would fit into their thinking, that would be very Jewish, very Hebrew in nature, that would fulfill their mentality, their idea of what a Messiah should be.
Mm.
And Jesus just says, it's not going to fit. It doesn't fit. I've got something so much greater than that planned for you.
Yeah.
The Lord has something so much greater. So that's what Jesus has said to the Pharisees, and says, we're not mourning right now. We're celebrating.
Yeah.
And the Pharisees are over there like, why aren't you fasting?
Yeah.
And he's like, you don't get it yet.
Yeah.
God's got this huge, incredible, brand new plan, and it doesn't fit into your system.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way.
And so instead of just saying it doesn't fit into your system, he gives, you know.
Gives parables. Which is what Jesus
Which is what we're going to go into today.
Where we're going today.
He's classic for that.
Yes.
And so, like I told you kind of before we started, I kind of like, I feel like the next chunk of scripture here kind of follows the same idea that what you just said. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're going into a new system, a new way of thinking, a new way of living. Jesus is bringing that in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think ultimately that's what leads to his death, you know? And so, kind of, I feel like as you go through this, you'll see as Jesus introduces these new ideas, I think you see that the, you know, the religious leaders of the day get more and more upset, more and more frustrated, and that's what ultimately leads to his death. But kind of following that same idea, breaking down another thing that they don't like happening, you know, do you want me to go ahead into verse 23 here?
Yeah, let's keep going.
So we jump into 23, and it says, so Jesus basically, it's the Sabbath day. I'll just start in 23. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and the disciples walked along, and they began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisee said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" So once again, we're doing something that, you know, back in the times of Moses and the law and all that sort of stuff, that was established that you weren't supposed to do that on the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus answered in verse 25, "Have you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar, the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat, and he also gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.'"
Hmm. Fighting words.
The Sabbath was such a huge deal to them.
Huge.
And he just like, it wasn't made for man for the Sabbath. Yeah. I'm the Son of Man, and I'm Lord of the Sabbath.
Oh.
So, take that.
Those are big words.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the second time in the book of Mark that Jesus claims the title, the Son of Man. And in this case, he claims lordship of the Sabbath.
Yeah.
Think about that for a minute.
Yeah.
He just claimed lordship of the Sabbath. That is, if that's not claiming to be God in flesh, then what is? Especially in the mind of a Jew. I think that we sometimes read over this quickly in our Western.
Yeah, mentality. That's an interesting little verse. Jesus is saying that the Sabbath day is, you know, made, you know, for man, and he's Lord of the Sabbath. Yeah, we knew he's Lord of the Sabbath. Cool beans. Let's keep moving. Yeah.
Yeah. But to say that, in relationship to the Jewish mentality, the Hebrew mentality, the law of Moses that says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. That is the law of Moses. And Jesus steps up and says, yes, by the way, I am the Son of Man and I am the Lord of the Sabbath day that you are to honor and that you are to keep holy.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So what he just claims here is absolute, no denying.
Yeah.
He's not shying away from it. He's claiming lordship of all.
Mm-hmm.
Because to be Lord of the Sabbath is to be Yahweh.
Yeah. Is a very elegant way of saying that, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's interesting because when he questions them, he says, why then was the Sabbath created? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what he's asking then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he says, do you not condemn David for doing what's unlawful?
Yeah.
Essentially, there's like, why are you condemning
me? I'm doing the exact same thing David did.
Same sort of stuff here.
Yeah.
And the question is, do you condemn David then? That's essentially what he's asking them. Are you going to stand here and condemn David for eating that? Because the obvious answer is, well, no. You're not condemning David.
Yeah, no,
like
you're not.
That was exactly what should have taken place.
It's a rhetorical question.
It is, it is. And it's, well, of course not. We're not condemning David. That would be ridiculous. That's foolish. And that's the question that he raises to them. And he demonstrates to them their double standard.
Yeah.
And he's getting at the heart of the law instead of the letter of the law.
Yeah.
Which is entirely different in some cases. Like, this is to say, who are you actually worshiping here?
Yeah.
You've set up a law code that you're more loyal to than the one who you claim the law code is set up for.
Yeah.
And he's getting right to the heart of the matter. He says, you're more inclined to pay attention to these laws and the code and the rules of the Sabbath.
Yeah.
Than the Lord of the Sabbath.
Absolutely.
And he's standing right in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we go through? I just want to go through. I think there's a lot to be talked about here. I'd like to finish Let's go through 3:6.
Okay. Let's do it.
Because I feel like this goes along the same exact idea.
Okay.
So it says another time. So here we go again. He went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, and now they're just looking, you know? They're like, oh, this guy's Lord of the Sabbath.
They're kind of onto him now. Like,
yeah.
It's like, this Jesus guy, we don't like him so much.
He has clearly shown that he doesn't want to fit into our system, and so
yeah,
not a fan.
Pharisees are basically like following him at this point.
Yeah.
Initially, it starts off in the book of Mark where it's the scribes of the Pharisees.
Yeah.
And then it's the scribes and the Pharisees, and then now it's just the Pharisees. Like,
yeah.
They're just like tracking with him.
Yeah.
They're just like following him around, and they're looking for something.
Yeah, looking for a reason to accuse him.
Yeah, yeah. Man, this story, it's great.
You're good. So they watched him closely here in verse 2 to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. So again, we're looking to, you know,
let's trap him.
Accuse Jesus again of something on the Sabbath.
Yep.
Jesus, and he's already declared to be the Lord of the Sabbath, so you know what's going to happen here. Jesus said to the man with a shriveled hand, stand up in front of everyone. So he doesn't heal him yet. Then Jesus asked him, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save a life or to kill?
Okay, and so he's looking at the Pharisees when he says this, right? I mean, that's the way.
But they remain silent.
And they just didn't sit there quietly.
He's like, watching. What are you going to say? Are you going to say it's better to do evil?
So just get this picture, right? We're sitting in a synagogue.
Yeah.
So right now we're sitting and we've got like... Maybe it's Mark, but he's not the apostle.
Sure, he's hanging
he's
out,
friend,
maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But we have a couple of these disciples, so probably Levi's with us.
Sure.
Peter's there. James and John are there. Those are the ones that we know he's called so far in the story.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there, and we're watching all this. And Jesus stands up and calls this guy over to stand with them. And he like reaches out, and he's looking at this guy's hand. So he's like holding this guy's hand in his hand.
Yeah.
And he turns over and just kind of takes a look at the Pharisees, and he's like, let me ask you guys a question.
Yeah.
Is it right to do good or to do evil on the Sabbath? And you got to know there's just this awkward pause.
Yeah. How do you answer that? You know?
As a Pharisee, you're like, oh.
I know what he's about to do.
He did it.
Yeah.
He did it. He went there, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm.
So he's holding this guy's hand, and you know they've seen him heal people before, and so they're like, shoot.
Man, what do you say?
And I'm sure there's other people around. There's a crowd,
And if
sure.
you say you do good, then you're...
giving him the right to heal the guy's hand.
You're putting your stamp of approval and blessing of the Pharisees upon it. Yeah,
which you don't want to do.
You can't do that.
Because you don't want to do...
You can't do that.
You don't want to break... Yeah, you don't want to break the Sabbath, you know?
And you can't say do evil, obviously.
He strapped him. Jesus is so cool with the way... I mean, obviously, he's Jesus. He's God. But,
he's pretty cool.
But the way he says stuff and the way he's able to like really get at the heart of a matter, super cool whenever you look at that.
Yeah. So they're silent.
They're silent. So he looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man...
Okay, can we... Before we keep going, can we just like pause and consider that? Jesus is angry and sorrowful.
Yeah.
That's the emotions that he's dealing with right in that moment. So as he's holding this guy's hand, he's looking at them, and he's got this mixed feeling of angry and deep, deep sadness. I mean, can you imagine, like, you're the Son of God, Jesus walking on earth, and the people who are supposed to be spreading and teaching your chosen people about the ways of God, who are the Pharisees, the religious rulers of the day, are literally hardening their hearts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like anger and sadness.
Yeah.
Dude, like that's just like, I had to like slow down on this part and just like really like try to take in the moment. And that's where it's like, wow. Everything that Jesus is feeling and thinking, just try to let it sit and ponder this as if you're sitting right next to those disciples and seeing this, and you're like, oh, you can see it on Jesus's face.
Yeah.
Oh, you can see it on the Pharisee's face.
Yeah.
And all the disciples are sitting back there like, what's about to happen.
This is for real.
And the guy standing there, how'd you like to be that guy?
Yeah, he's like, can you just heal my hand or let me go?
Right.
This is getting awkward. Right.
So he tells the man, stretch out your hand.
And he was completely restored. And his hand was restored. Then the Pharisees, here we go, went out and began to plot.
And immediately.
Yep, immediately.
Oh, that word again. Immediately, the Pharisees
plot with the Herodians,
plotting
how they might kill Jesus. Yeah.
Dude, what a story.
So interesting. And that's what I was kind of saying before we started. I feel like, right at the beginning of this, Jesus is starting in on the old covenant and the ways of thinking of the Pharisees, mm-hmm. and starting to break that down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really comes, you know, pretty much full circle.
Yeah.
At this first passage in 3.
Yep.
Where he's saying, you know, that's the old, this is the new.
And I think what's really interesting here is when you read the first couple, and I don't want to use chapters, but the first phase of Mark, the first section of Mark, we hear immediately with Jesus, he was immediately moved to the wilderness. He immediately went and did this. He immediately went here, there, and there. Like, we see that pattern. And then on the contrasting side, when Jesus approaches and is dealing with the Pharisees, they immediately go the other way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like this compare contrast.
Mm-hmm.
We also have talked about the compare contrast with John in the wilderness and the Pharisees in Jerusalem and Jesus walking down by the sea and the Pharisees in Jerusalem. And now Jesus is being immediately pushed by the Spirit and led to the wilderness. And the Pharisees are immediately going to the Herodians.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, just the whole picture here is just night and day.
Just clashing sides.
Just
you
complete
know?
Contrast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's so good.
And I think you said something just a little earlier. You said, I think the words you used were the it just kind of gets driven home here. The Pharisees were going by the letter of the law rather than, what do you say, like the spirit of the law or something?
Yeah, I said the spirit of the law.
And I think that's so huge here. And I think something...
Or maybe the purpose of the law.
I wrote down something here, like what Jesus is doing, and I think it's important that we sometimes say the old covenant is gone, you know, and Jesus came to, like, you know, get rid of it or establish, maybe not even get rid of, but establish something new. Mm-hmm. And he did. But he wasn't saying that the old covenant was garbage, you know?
No.
I mean, he wasn't saying. What he was doing is he's going in and saying, here's what the old covenant is, but here's the spirit of the old covenant. And I'm fulfilling the spirit of the old covenant. The old covenant wasn't just a whole bunch of laws that we thought were really cool. That was like, hey, we're going to make your life really hard. I think what it was saying is, you know, what Jesus said here, like in the first part of 3, is he said, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or do evil, to save a life or to kill? And he's not quoting like a specific law, I don't think here, but he's saying like, which is better, to do good or do evil, to save a life or to kill?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's to do good and to save a life, which I feel like is the spirit of the law.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What you're after with the law is to do good,
mm-hmm.
to save a life. That's what the law is after, and that's what Jesus is getting at here.
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying the law is garbage. He's saying that this is what the law is trying to get you to do.
Yeah.
And I'm showing you that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something that I really thought was interesting, in Isaiah 58, it denounces ritualistic fasting.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about fasting and how sometimes, like, you can go and read it, but it talks about how whenever, like, they fasted, they would get into arguments and stuff like this, and it would turn out to be, like, it would be, like it says, ritualistic, and you're just doing it for the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And Isaiah is denouncing that, and he's saying, don't do ritualistic fasting.
Right.
That's against the spirit of the law. You're doing a law, technically, by fasting, and it kind of jumps back in here because, you know, Jesus is questioned about fasting. Like, why are they not fasting?
Mm-hmm.
And again, his answer is because the bridegroom's here. Mm-hmm. But he could also go down the line of reasoning of, you know, what's the purpose of fasting?
Yeah.
You know, is the purpose of fasting just to fast?
Right, right. So this opens up a whole discussion that we're going to have to spend an entire podcast on sometime down the road, because it is so important, because I'm not saying by any means that Jesus is throwing out the
oh,
law.
Absolutely that, not. That's no, I not think that's what gets kind of like...
It's either or.
Yeah,
we
the think old of law's it, gone, the new law's here.
Yeah,
boom, done.
We think of it as an either or. Either you follow the law or you don't. And Jesus is like, there's a deeper level here. It's not just whether or not you follow the letter of the law or you don't. It's what is the heart of the law.
Exactly.
And because Jesus, especially on the Sermon on the Mount in the book of Matthew, and I try not to cross-reference here too much, but we're going to have to just for this sake of this discussion.
Sure, yeah.
Is Jesus said, what's the law say about divorcing, about a man that divorces his wife? He says, give her a letter and you may divorce. That's what Moses has said.
Yeah.
But I say to you, and he goes to the deeper level.
Yeah.
And he says, this might be what's written down, but that was because of the hardness of your heart.
Yeah.
He says, but there's a deeper level here.
Yeah.
And he gets down to the deeper meaning. He says, but if you divorce, then that's this level. And what's the purpose? And what's the spirit of it? God, from the beginning, intended it be not so.
Interesting.
From the very beginning, God did not intend for divorce to be a part of a marriage. Like, because that's what was happening, especially in the religious leaders. They would have a marriage, and sometimes it would last a year, a couple years. Oh, tired. Okay, let's move on. Here's your certificate of divorce. Get married again. No problem.
Yeah.
And then a
few years
later.
Moses said I could do this.
It's fine. I can do this. Here's another certificate of divorce. And marry the next lady the next year. And they would do that. This was a practice. Especially in the culture of like the Romans and the Greeks. I mean, this was no problem. This is how the other countries and other cultures practiced.
Yeah.
And so the Hebrews would look around and said, well, we can divorce. What's the big deal?
Sure.
And so you'd have these religious leaders who would have multiple wives following the letter of the law.
Yeah.
But you miss the heart.
Yeah.
You've completely missed it.
Oh, yeah.
And so Jesus hits on what is the purpose? What is the meaning? And here he's talking about specifically the Sabbath.
Yeah.
And he says, just because you're following the letter doesn't mean that you get it.
Yeah, exactly.
Think about what you're doing. Think about why you're doing it. Think about he of whom the Sabbath is created.
Yeah.
And then he goes back and says, but the Sabbath wasn't actually created in order for you to follow it. The Sabbath was created for humanity.
Yeah.
To remember their God.
Yeah, a day of, you know, remembering who God is.
Yeah.
You know, that's the purpose of the Sabbath.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Oh,
it's so cool what Jesus does there. And I think just kind of probably how you were raised and I was raised, it's just like the old covenant's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And what a, you know, we've talked about this so many times, but what a, you know, way to fill in and kind of color our understanding of the old covenant was not abolished.
No.
And what a way to understand the, like, I've always kind of been confused whenever Jesus was like, I've come to fulfill the old covenant. I'm like, well, how?
Yeah.
But that, you know, Jesus obviously didn't come to practice all the rules that were set out.
Right.
But he's come to, like you say, on the letter, on the Sermon on the Mount, he's come to show the spirit of those.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So cool,
and if we simply stopped at what the letter says.
Yeah.
Think about like how shallow of a relationship with God we would have. And that's what's happened
with
the Pharisees. They just stopped at the letter. And Jesus is saying, man, there's so much more. So much more than this. Don't just stop at the letter. You're missing the heart of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And he's bringing the heart of the issue to the surface.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that the whole Old New Testament or Old New Covenant we could do forever.
Oh,
but
for sure.
Anyway, we
for
need
sure.
to move on or we're never going to get anywhere.
we can talk
about get
this
somewhere,
a long
but
time.
Maybe not actually through the what we're trying to get through. So we can keep moving here. I mean, I feel like that's kind of a good, maybe not a good, like, I don't know. I kind of feel like it's divided out a little bit, but, after this, Jesus, my Bible says, the crowd follows Jesus is the next kind of section here.
Crowd is following Jesus.
I don't know. Do you have anything kind of like this? And then you have the crowd following Jesus, you know, he does a few more things. And then you have the appointing of the 12 apostles. And then after that, you have, I feel like the next part that really kind of I had a lot of questions and ideas about was you have several parables Jesus tells, and I feel like that's where I kind of dug in a little bit more in this passage. Do you have anything to say about that latter part of, you know, middle and latter part of chapter 3?
Yeah, just a little bit. I mean, well, first of all, we could go through the list of the disciples. Boy, let's see. Well, first of all, starting in verse 7.
Yeah, you do have the says, going to the sea again.
Yeah, we have him going to the sea again, and it talks about this crowd is from all over the place.
Yeah, he's got a
from
following,
man. Galilee to Judea. I mean, that's from basically northern and southern Israel, from Jerusalem, beyond the Jordan, Tyre, Sidon. That's all the way over by the Mediterranean. This is a large crowd, it says, that came to see him. Now, at the beginning of this book, and just not too long ago, we were talking about how he said, don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Don't tell anybody.
Well, didn't happen. And somehow people figured it out.
Yeah, but here's the thing. When you think about some of the healings that took place,
yeah,
I don't know that any of them were actually private. Mm. Think about the ones that Jesus healed the paralytic through the roof.
Yeah.
It's because there was a huge crowd pressing in on
him. Yeah, exactly.
When
well, there was no way that this was Jesus. I mean, who is it? Was it John's mother?
Yeah.
Who is it?
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
That one may have been private, you know, but all these other ones, you've got
he was
people
in the
around.
He was in the synagogue.
Yeah.
So when we were talking about, like, why is Jesus trying to keep it, like, hush, hush? The word's out. And I'm not really, I think that's maybe more of something for us to ponder and consider as we talked about how this is, like, meditative. We're considered this. But the reality is the word is getting out about Jesus, and he wasn't really trying to keep it under wraps.
Yeah.
The huge crowd had come to see him in his house, and they ripped up the roof, and he heals him with everybody present.
Yeah.
He's standing in the synagogue, and he heals him with everybody present.
That's true.
So all these, and we talked about how many people had come to him near the sea, and he was healing them, and I think that's even going to be talked about more here in just a second. So he has started his public ministry. There's nothing private.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right now.
I think the easier part of that to understand, I mean, if you skip down to verse 12 again, well, 11 and 12, he's driving out evil spirits, and again, the evil spirits are like, you were the Son of God, and he says he gave them strict orders not to tell who he was. So I think that's the easier aspect of that to understand, of him not saying, hey, don't tell everybody I'm the Son of God. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think that's easier to understand than, you know, him just not wanting anybody to know what he was doing, you know?
Right, yep.
So.
For sure. So then he went up the mountain, it says. Now, this is interesting because it doesn't tell us which mountain, but apparently we're supposed to either know which mountain, or it's a literary moment where he says he ascended the mountain. Well, we can think of several people in the Old Testament who ascended the mountain.
Yeah, mountainside or mountaintop.
Yeah.
I guess experiences are fairly well known, you know, throughout the Old Testament.
Absolutely.
That's a literary, you know, marker that something significant
pay
is about to happen. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Pay attention.
You don't go up on a mountain to take a nap.
No. He goes up the mountain, so he's like, hey, pay attention. What's going on? He summoned those he wanted, and they came to him, and he appointed the 12.
Yeah.
And he named them the apostles, and he sent them out to preach and have authority to drive out demons.
Yeah.
Up until this point,
That hasn't happened. Yeah.
He has been the one that's driven out demons, that's hushed demons, that's caused them to be silent. But he calls the 12 and he gives them authority, and he lists them off here. Simon, he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, his brother John, and goes on and on and on. Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. So we have the list here.
Yeah. So interesting that he goes ahead and, you know, designates Judas.
Right.
Even knowing he's going to betray him.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely.
That's food for thought, but, you know.
We could talk more about this list, too, but I think we're going to have to keep on rolling.
Sure.
I wish we could pause, but, oh, dude.
There's a lot of stuff. Once
so
we get into the parables, we're going to get into parables here in a second, and then that's going to be just the end of everything. So.
Yeah, for sure. So we get on to the place where it's a house divided. He went home. He goes home.
Yeah.
And a crowd gathers there at his house so that they were not able to eat. When his family heard this, they sent out to restrain him because they said he is out of his mind. They think that Jesus is crazy. These are his brothers and sisters, family members that saying this guy's gone nuts.
Bummer. That'd be a bad feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being his family, growing up with your brother?
I'm going to be honest. I didn't even notice this was his house.
Yeah.
Like, end the story. And I did not realize this was his family.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that until now. Interesting.
Yeah.
I won't say anything.
But this is such a unique time in Jesus' ministry where his own family members are like, what's wrong with him?
He's out of his mind.
He's gone crazy.
He's straight nutso.
He thinks he's God. He thinks he is the Son of God.
Is Mary around during this?
It says his family.
I mean, like, she knows, like, had an angel come to her and said, hey, you're going to have the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's another thing that we could spend a lot of time on. So they said he's gone crazy. So his own family is under the impression that Jesus has straight lost it.
Absolutely.
Bummer.
Yeah, and we know this later because James, the brother of Jesus, wasn't a follower of Jesus until after the resurrection. Until he saw the resurrection of Jesus, he did not follow.
Yeah.
He was not a follower of Jesus.
Interesting.
Yeah.
He certainly was afterwards.
Oh,
but
absolutely.
100%. Absolutely. But yeah.
And we'll have those discussions later on.
Yeah.
But they think that Jesus has gone crazy, out of his mind. And so the scribes, well, we've seen these guys before, who came down from Jerusalem, said he has Beelzebub in him. And he drives out the demons by the ruler of the demons. And Jesus is just like, you guys are crazy. And he says, how can Satan drive out Satan? They say, you can't use the same army to destroy its own army.
Yeah.
That's what he's claiming. That's what they are claiming.
Yeah.
They say, you have a devil in you.
He's like,
and you're using the devil to drive out the smaller devils.
He's like, you have a major logical fallacy right here. I mean, oh my gosh. I don't even have to break down this argument you've already broken down your own argument.
Do I have to make a parable for you? Let me try.
let me try to make one, even though it's going to be hard because it's so obvious.
If a kingdom is divided against itself, the kingdom cannot stand. If a house is divided against itself, the house cannot stand. And if Satan rebels against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but is finished. On the other hand, no one can enter a strong man's house and rob his possessions unless he first ties up the strong man, and then he will rob his house. I assure you, people will be forgiven for all sins and whatever blasphemes they may blaspheme, but whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit never has forgiveness but is guilty of eternal sin. He says this because they were saying he has an unclean spirit. So he is warning them. He says, you're claiming that I am possessed by an unclean spirit, by the devil. He says, be careful. This is the Holy Spirit you're speaking about.
Okay, gotcha.
So he says, listen, if you are going to blaspheme the Holy Spirit, you are in danger. You're in danger here. And he also goes, before he makes that statement, he says, no one can enter a strong man's house and rob its possessions until he first ties up the strong man. What had Jesus been doing? He had been going and binding up the demons. Binding up. Jesus had been binding the power of the demons so that he could eradicate them. And so this is like Jesus saying, listen, guys, you're calling me filled with the devil. You need to be careful. You don't get it. And first of all, I'm not filled with the devil if I'm driving out demons. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Look at what you're saying. Just consider this.
So I have a couple of things, and they both may be cancer worms. But so I feel like I've heard this scripture preached on before and probably taken out of context.
Okay.
The whole idea of a kingdom is divided itself, that kingdom cannot stand. If a house is divided itself, it can't stand.
Mm-hmm.
like, I feel like that's taken out of context and preached on.
Okay.
Do you feel like that? Like, I feel like I've heard that, sure. You know, like, preached on before. Do you think Jesus is saying more here than, hey, I'm obviously not demon-possessed? Do you think he's saying more there? Do you think there's, like, more to be taken from that?
What do you have something in mind, I
no,
think.
No, I mean, not really. I just feel like I have this idea of, like, you know, like, we all need to, I don't know, we all need to be united because the kingdom against itself cannot stand. Jesus says that. So a church needs to be one unified body, you know? And so Jesus says that, you know, if we're divided against ourselves, we can't stand. So I've heard that used kind of in reference as, you know, that the body of Christ needs to be united. And I just feel like, yes, that probably is true, but that really, I don't, from reading this, I don't really feel like that's what Jesus is getting at here.
I think that you've touched on something that is very common.
Yeah.
In preaching, because we catch onto a phrase.
Yeah.
Here's the problem with being a pastor.
Yeah.
Here's the one of the struggles that we face is as a pastor, as a preacher, we say, "Oh man, yeah, we don't want to have a divided church, and this is the house of God, so let's make sure, because this is the word of Jesus, a house divided cannot stand." Man, that fits, especially if there's bickering going on in the church.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's about the carpet or new pews or we're painting something or we're going to spend money on this or that or not. You know, this is something easy we can say. Jesus said, a house divided cannot stand.
Yeah, which is true. I mean.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. But is that the point? And here's the thing that we have to always go back to when preaching. You have to go back to what is the purpose of the author? What is the purpose of what Jesus was saying?
Yeah.
And so is it wrong to use that in context of a divided church? Well, not entirely.
I mean,
but
it doesn't make the statement wrong, but is that what Jesus was Jesus meaning to say? Oh, I'm going to use this.
Was that the purpose of Jesus
absolutely
when he made
not.
That?
Absolutely
not.
No,
absolutely not. He was making a statement based upon what the Pharisees were accusing him of having a demon.
Yeah.
That's a far cry different from the color of carpet or a new pew or spending money in a particular area. So, I just think as pastors, we have to be careful to not say, oh, this will work for my sermon illustration.
Yeah.
Or this fits the scenario that I'm currently in. We need to be really careful about that. I'm not saying that you can never, ever, ever use something that was, but we always need to look at what is the context in which it was written, because what has happened so many times, we build our own theology towers based off of a few verses.
Yeah.
And we don't want to build our own theology tower that does not coincide exactly with the scripture and what it's teaching. And especially if we're building a tower when it's something like this.
Yeah.
If we're talking about a unity of the church, well, what is that actually what Jesus is saying here? Is he talking about the unity of the church?
I mean, he does talk about it, but he's not talking about it there.
Right.
Yeah.
Later on he does, but not
here.
Sure,
no.
And so don't use this passage as your unity of the church passage.
Sure.
This is something different.
Yeah.
Are there passages that we can use for unity of the church?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, many. Yeah.
So many. And absolutely we should. We should use those and hang on to those and love those and preach those. Absolutely. But we need to see the context.
Yeah.
Use the context in which it was written. This is Jesus saying, look, Satan, his power is getting bound up.
Yeah.
He is being bound. And Jesus has a much greater power in him, the power of the Holy Spirit, coming in that is binding the power of Satan, that is destroying the strong man's house, who has had some time of fun and rule and reign within these people.
Yeah.
He is binding them. That's what Jesus is saying here.
Yeah.
And so we need to be careful when approaching those passages that we actually understand, take a chance to look, what is the surrounding context?
Yeah.
And what is Jesus saying?
I think the problem with that is if you're not careful, like I literally, like I'm reading through my Bible right now and that's the only verse, like verse 24 and 25 are the only verses I have underlined because like, I'm sure I've had this Bible for a long time, but I'm sure sometime I listened to a passage and I was like, man, that's a great verse. Yeah. I can just pull that out. And the problem is, whenever you're reading through and you just read those two verses, your mind will automatically start going towards, that's a unity of the church verse.
Right.
And you won't read those in context, or at least I won't.
Right.
I'll read those, you know, oh, why is Jesus talking about the unity of the church, and then goes back into the mm-hmm. idea of, like, you know,
yeah,
Satan and opposing. I feel like you can understand it, but your mind starts going to, oh, I need to pull something additional from this verse.
Yeah.
And that takes away, in my mind, from what you should be pulling from it.
When I was 12 years old, about 12, I got a new Bible.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's
exciting.
Like, yeah, yeah.
You were cool.
Excited. Well, actually, our car got stolen and broken into, and
took your Bible?
The car got stolen and my Bible was robbed.
They just took your Bible. This is a nice one. It's leather bound.
No, they took my yo-yo too. So,
oh.
I mean, that was the days when yo-yos were cool.
Yeah.
So,
you had a really weird car thief.
I had a weird car thief.
He took your Bible and your yo-yo?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, man. So he took my Bible. So I ended up getting a new Bible when I was 12. And I kept
yo-yo.
That Bible. Yeah, I got a new yo-yo too.
Thank God.
So, man, it was a Yomega.
Whoa.
Super cool. Yeah.
Walk the
yeah.
dog.
Right. Oh, yes. Baby in the Cradle. All those. Around the world.
Dang. Okay. Man. New Bible.
So I got a new Bible when I was 12 years old. And I started highlighting and marking under pretty much any sermon that would be preached on.
Sure.
Like
yeah.
the main point. Hey, this is the main point of this sermon.
Yeah.
So go ahead and highlight it or mark it or anything to maybe write a small little note off to the side.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I had used that Bible all the way through high school. When I got to college, I used it some but not quite as much just because it was a little bit bigger. I wanted
yeah.
a little bit more compact Bible
yeah.
for college. And then once I became an adult and I kind of picked up that old Bible again, I used it for a little bit, but I realized that it was not the same Bible that we were using at our church. We weren't preaching out of
yeah.
that version. So I was like, I kind of want more of a version that lines up with what most other people in our church are using.
Yeah.
So I grabbed a brand new Bible.
Brand
new Bible, yeah. No markings on it.
Yeah.
And I began to read the Bible without any preconceived lenses.
Yeah, so without your markings, without
your
little
my
notes.
Markings. And
yeah.
and the Bible really began to come alive for me
yeah.
in that moment. Because what would happen as I would read that Bible that I got when I was 12,
yeah.
whenever I came to a passage that was preached out of, I would automatically think, this is the application for this verse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Based upon what I had heard preached.
Yeah.
Or based upon whether I'd memorized it when I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
or whether or not I had, you know, heard some evangelist or missionary
yeah.
use this passage. I automatically assumed, oh, this is a missionary passage, or oh, this is an evangelist salvation message, or oh, this is a church unity passage.
Yeah.
I could really easily jump to that. But because I didn't have any of those markings, I began to read it for what the Bible said itself.
Yeah.
And I quit using lenses
uh-huh.
and different things to focus in on different things. And that was a game changer.
Oh, yeah.
Because when I began to take away these things that would channel my thoughts
yeah.
towards a particular road or
mm-hmm.
towards a particular thought pattern
sure.
and just let the Bible speak for itself, let the entire story, the entire narrative
yeah.
speak for itself, dude, that was a game changer.
Oh, yeah.
That was a complete game changer. And at the same time, I started journaling what I was working through in passages of scripture. So I'd begin to read like the book of Romans or
yeah.
1 Corinthians and I'd write stuff down. And instead of using like these five verses that mean this, I would see it in the entire context of the book. And I would see the entire heart of what Paul is getting at.
Sure.
And man, when you do that and stop cherry picking favorite verses
yeah.
out of context, it's a completely different experience. And I believe that's the way God intends us
yeah.
to look at scriptures
yeah.
is a unified whole. The entire Bible is speaking to the truths of Jesus, and especially within the entire books.
Yeah.
The author, the entire book is usually driving home a couple primary points.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we get distracted with little verbiage
sure.
things. And we're like,
sure.
Oh, man, this fits. This
yeah.
fits in this passage.
Yeah.
This fits in this sermon. This fits this illustration. And we need to be really careful about that.
Yeah.
And let the Bible speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
The unified story that all points to what Jesus has done on the cross,
mm-hmm.
what he is fulfilling in all human history,
yeah.
and what he is promised to do in the hearts of individuals who follow him.
Yeah.
That's what
so
it's
cool.
all about. It's
yeah.
so awesome.
I
so
think
awesome.
That we should cut that little story of you getting a new Bible to right now and make that like the purpose of this podcast. You
oh,
know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like that was a really good summary. Like,
yeah.
you know, not that, you know, reading the Bible one way or another is wrong,
mm-hmm.
but being able to, you know, I again, this is for people, you know, I feel like people can listen to this who have read the Bible or haven't read the Bible or been reading the Bible for years, but a way of looking at the Bible.
Absolutely.
A way of understanding it.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
love it.
Super cool.
Yeah.
That
just
was
to,
awesome.
Just to finish out chapter 3, and then let's wrap up our time together here.
Okay.
One more thing. Verse 31 says, then his mother and his brothers came and standing outside. So you know they're just like inside the house
yeah.
this whole time.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
he's just had this little session with the scribes talking about, you know, you can't bind up this guy. Like, you binding
yeah.
up the strong man and,
yeah.
and all this. And his mother and his brothers come out standing there, and they sent word to him saying, get him inside here. Would you please bring Jesus inside here? But a crowd was sitting around him, and they told him, look, your mother and your brothers and your sisters are outside asking for you to come on over to them. And he replied to them, listen, who are my mother and my brothers? And looking about those who are sitting in a circle around him, he said, here are my brother. This is my mother. And whoever does the will of God is my brother and my sister and my mother.
Yeah. I think that the understanding of in verse 20, it's his family who's like, this dude is straight crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that almost paints the end of this passage in such a different light. Because I always
yeah.
feel, again, this one is like cherry picked, I feel like,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the time. This verse.
Yeah.
Of
we don't connect it to verse 20.
No, we don't.
Earlier
this
there.
Is just, oh, Jesus says that, you know, whoever
does
follows
the will of my
him,
father,
yeah.
he's my family.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, Jesus will say later, you know, whoever, you know, is not willing to leave their
mm-hmm.
mother and father.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse me. And sister, like, you know, that is what is expected.
Absolutely.
And I think it's just really interesting that, I guess, always in my mind, I just felt like Jesus' family was always on board with him, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like, his brothers and mother and stuff were probably always like, yeah, yeah, we follow this dude.
Yeah.
He knows what he's talking. And obviously right here, they're like, no,
nope.
We were kind of thinking he'd keep this whole Jesus, like, son of God thing under wraps. And now he's kind of gone.
No, he's really doing crazy
okay.
stuff.
He's,
yeah.
Yeah. We're just going to say he's crazy.
Yeah.
And so I always felt like this was a super harsh verse, but
mm.
it's not harsh at all. He's
right.
basically saying, yes, if my mother and brother and, you know, my family was like on board with me, were the people that were, like, you
yeah.
know, listening to me. Yes, they are my
mm-hmm.
family. But he's saying that, no, you know,
mm-hmm.
they are not my family right now. My family
mm-hmm.
are you who sit around me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You do the will of God, you are my family.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he's not saying that his family couldn't do the will of God.
Mm-mm.
But he's
mm-hmm.
making this stark distinction. He's like, they're calling me crazy right now.
Black and white again.
Yeah.
It's the whole distinction. We're seeing the people who are following God and those who don't get it. And right
yeah.
now, his family is in the boat.
Does, yeah.
With everybody else, like the Pharisees and the scribes, they don't see it.
They
don't
get
it. They don't
yeah.
get it.
He's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So interesting. Makes that verse a lot less harsh in my mind.
Mm.
It always just kind of seemed like Jesus was like, yeah, yeah, my family wants to see me, but
right.
I don't want to see them. You guys who I want to chill with. But
yeah.
they're the ones who just said he's crazy, and they're
yeah.
in that boat of,
yeah.
we don't get it.
Yeah, they don't get it. And
yeah.
you know that this is a moment in Jesus, like, if you could look into his mind, see his heart
yeah.
and the sympathy that was on his face,
mm-hmm.
you know this is like, you see his mother over there
yeah.
and his siblings. And he's
you
like,
know he loves them.
He loves
you know?
Them.
He's still a human. I mean, they're still
yeah.
his family.
Yeah.
He loves them. But
and
he's like, ah, I've got a bigger purpose.
They don't understand
yeah.
why I'm here yet.
Yeah.
They will one day.
Yeah.
But right now, they don't get it.
Yeah.
Wow. What a story.
Very interesting.
Very
cool.
Very cool.
Definitely some stuff I've learned.
Yeah. Yeah. So next time we'll jump in.
Ooh, the parables.
The parables.
Well, a few parables here. Not all of the parables. That'd be a little much. Yeah.
Man, this next section.
Oh, it's gonna be awesome.
This next passage is incredible.
Yeah.
Can't wait. Can't wait to jump in.
Yeah, me neither.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Discovery Bible Podcast. Join us next week as we continue on with Mark chapter 4, and we begin to look at some of the parables, the parable of the sower, parable of the mustard seed, parable of growing seed, and letting your light shine. So join us next week as we continue this discussion in the Gospel of Mark.